Rita Moreno in West Side Story.
And when he called my name out, the place went crazy. Latinos were sticking their heads out the windows screaming, "She did it! She did it!" I can't believe it! Good Lord! I leave you with that.
Rita Moreno accepting her Academy Award from Rock Hudson back in 1962. She just turned 90 on Saturday, and I'll speak with her about her long career and the latest iteration of West Side Story later in the show. First, though, Governor Gavin Newsom's big announcement on Saturday that he'll push state lawmakers to pass legislation allowing Californians to sue anyone who makes, distributes, or sells an assault weapon or one of those ghost guns. He's essentially copying Texas, using that state's restrictive abortion law as a model for California. Here to weigh in on that and the legality of it, the constitutionality of it, is Press Play's legal Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Hi.
Hi, my favorite title. Happy Monday.
You have many titles. Happy Monday to you. All right. So when he made that announcement, he explicitly referred to the Texas abortion law and the fact that the Supreme Court basically let it stand on Friday. And we'll get into the reasoning in a moment. But first, what exactly is the governor proposing here? How would it work?
So exactly what you said, which is that he would outlaw the manufacture and sale of assault weapons and ghost gun kits. I think we should flag for people that those are parts of the penal code right now. Some of them are kind of on hold while the Ninth Circuit reviews, for instance, the assault weapon ban. But what would be different is that he would create a private right of action. So as opposed to our gun laws now, where if you violate them, it's the state that enforces that violation. The difference would be that he's saying, okay, Supreme Court, you're telling me that a private right of action means I'm insulating a law from federal court review. I'll create a gun control law with a private right of action.
So is he explicitly saying, well, I'm doing this is he doing this because he really wants to empower citizens to do that? Or is he making more of a political statement about what happened in Texas with abortion?
I think both. I mean, I think he really would like to make sure that our assault weapons ban and our ban on ghost gun kits is enforceable and is used in California. And I think he's also, frankly, doing what he often does, which is he's reading the political tea leaves. He saw a new legal ruling and he's saying, I'm going to be the first in the nation. So Supreme Court, if you say that this is the roadmap for states to pass laws where you can basically protect those laws from federal judicial review, as long as it's a private individual, not the state that's enforcing those laws, then I'll go ahead and see that bet and I'll raise you a gun control law. So I think it's legal and political.
And it was something that the justices actually foresaw when they heard arguments on the Texas abortion law. Here's a clip from Justice Brett Kavanaugh from back in September.
The amicus brief of the Firearms Policy Coalition says, quote, this will easily become the model for suppression of other constitutional rights, with Second Amendment rights being the most likely targets, end quote. And it could be free speech rights, it could be free exercise of religion rights, it could be Second Amendment rights. If this position is accepted here, the theory of the amicus brief is that it can be easily replicated in other states that disfavor other constitutional rights.
So he was posing that question to, or he was speaking to one of the lawyers for Texas. What was the answer to that query?
The answer was basically yes. So, I mean, in lots of words, the answer was, well, let's focus on this particular case, Justice Kavanaugh, and let's focus on what we're doing here, which I think reading between the lines, the advocates said to Justice Kavanaugh, is something we all want to do, which is to impose stricter abortion laws. And I think in some ways that telegraphs the fact that Justice Kavanaugh and other justices were trying to figure out, well, if we make this ruling with respect to Texas's case, then what's going to happen in blue states? And of course, that is the big, interesting, and probably already answered question.
Okay, so let's say this happens and the California state legislature passes this as Governor Newsom has called them to do, and there is a court challenge. What would happen next?
Yeah, and I think he's inviting the court challenge. I mean, I think Governor Newsom basically read that a Supreme Court decision, or a staff did, and he said, okay, and now let's, you know, offer people a challenge in federal district court once we pass this. So first, what happens is it would be challenged in the trial court, and then it would be appealed up to the Ninth Circuit. And then frankly, I think his hope is probably that it would be appealed and accepted by the Supreme Court. Because in a way, if Governor Newsom loses before the Supreme Court, if California loses, then it's still, I think, a bit of a political win, because he can say, well, I pushed the boundaries of what this conservative Supreme Court had said, and I tried to protect you. If he wins, which I suspect that he wouldn't, then he could say, look what I did. I've enshrined the protection against assault weapons and gun control and ghost gun kits. So this is a long way from us having an answer, though. It has to be passed, challenged in the trial court, court of appeals, and then we wait to see if the Supreme Court would take it. This is not weeks or months.
Right. Well, constitutionally, it differs. Guns differ, right, from abortion rights because gun rights are explicitly protected in the Second Amendment, whereas abortion rights are not explicitly protected in the Constitution.
Right. So there's a couple of differences, and they kind of cut both ways. One, as you said, which is the Second Amendment obviously is written in the Constitution. The Constitution with respect to abortion rights doesn't specifically say there's a right to privacy. The court over decades has said there is this right to privacy. And then starting in 1973 with Roe said, and it does protect a woman's ability to obtain an abortion. So in a way, Governor Newsom is on very different ground, though, because he is saying, let's outlaw assault weapons and ghost gun kits. And it's not at all clear that that's unconstitutional under current law. Texas passed a law where it is clearly unconstitutional under current law. I think what I suspect, though, is that the Second Amendment is a favored right among this court, and abortion rights are a disfavored right, and that will really be the difference here.
Mm. Okay, well, speaking of, let's talk about what the court decided on Friday. What did they say, and what does it mean for the future of this law in Texas?
Yes. So Texas, as we know, this case was just about who can sue and be sued, more importantly, to try and stop Texas's law from staying in effect. This wasn't the big case, you know, can Texas constitutionally impose a 6-week ban on abortion? And what the court said here is abortion providers can only sue people who are essentially medical board personnel, members of the Texas government who oversee medical professionals. And that is, I really struggle with whether I characterize this as a win at all for abortion providers. If it is, it is the narrowest of wins for a couple of reasons. The court said you can't sue court clerks, you can't sue state court judges, you can't sue the state attorney general. All of those people are the obvious officials to sue and would allow abortion providers to get something called a statewide injunction, meaning Texas's law would not be applied anywhere. Now, with respect to going forward, the abortion providers being able to sue just these medical board professionals, I think it's unclear if they can ever get that statewide injunction, which is what you need. You don't want this law just can't be applied as to these people. You want it prohibited statewide, period. So all long way of saying, if it's a victory, it's a really small one for abortion providers.
Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal here on Press Play. Coming up, Rita Moreno is here to talk about starring in the West Side Story remake, and we'll get into her life in Hollywood, including her long relationship with Marlon Brando.
I knew him inside out. I remember my psychotherapist at the time saying, "You have a PhD in Marlonology."
Rita Moreno is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
I like the island Manhattan.
I know you do.
Smoke on your pipe and good Latin.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a small fee in America.
Okay.
Rita Moreno, in her career-defining role as Anita in the 1961 film West Side Story, she won an Oscar for it. She was the first Latina to win an Oscar. It was a meatier role than she had received in the past, where she'd been typecast, really, in demeaning island girl or ethnic roles. And yet, despite her breakthrough success in West Side Story, she wasn't offered good film roles for years after. And so, she went on TV. In 1971, she joined the Electric Company, a brand new children's show on PBS, and she won a Grammy for the album related to that show. And later, she won a couple of Emmys for other TV roles. Now, as she has just turned 90 years old this weekend, she has received a huge birthday present. The opening of Steven Spielberg's remake of West Side Story, in which she plays the role of Doc, the shopkeeper renamed Valentina, and the moral center of the story. Rita Moreno is also the subject of a Netflix documentary, which takes us from her birth in Puerto Rico to her love affair with Marlon Brando to her life today. And Rita Moreno is here now. Welcome to the program and happy birthday.
Thank you. I know. Isn't it amazing? I mean, I'm just amazed. Who knew I was going to last this long?
Well, not only last, but thrived. I mean, I have to ask you, how do you do it? How are you so vibrant at age 90?
Oh, God, I don't know how to answer a question like that. I have no idea. All I know is that here I am and how fabulous that is. And I'm in an extraordinary movie and actually extraordinary. Wow. I was at the opening, and I've never seen an audience react that way in a movie theater. They were reacting as though they were in a live theater and applauding and hooting and hollering after every number. It was extraordinary.
So how did you conceive of your role as Valentina? You are the shopkeeper, played in the original by a man, and the character's name is Doc. So how did you want to rethink about your interpretation of that role?
Well, you know, let me put it in Spielberg's words. He says she's the grown-up in the room, and she is the heart of the movie. And I think that's absolutely so. The heart in the sense that it's also the conscience of the movie. And it's a marvelous part. And it's a marvelous part only because Tony Kushner, the playwright who initially wrote Angels
Angels in America. Mm-hmm.
And he decided by himself that instead of Doc, who ran the candy store where the Jets hung out, which really wasn't much of a part, he decided that I would be a swell Doc's widow, Valentina, who's also Puerto Rican. And that's just maybe one of the finest things that has ever happened to me ever in my whole life, because I now have the advantage of saying the words of a glorious playwright's mind. Oh, boy, is he good. You know, he took all the stuff from West Side Story that wasn't, all the omissions that were made, not deliberately, of course, but they were made. And he fixed all that. He got it right. And it wasn't, of course, just him. It was himself and Spielberg. But they were determined to make a film where Hispanics could play Hispanics. And that's just for starters.
Yeah.
And he also took in the social and the political situation in the sense that the place where these kids lived, these gangs in the ghetto, was a place where that was being knocked down to kick them out, which it did do, thousands of people. I mean, this is based on something absolutely that happened.
Mm-hmm.
He took that all in and made people aware, which did not begin to happen in the original, of how devastating that was.
So this is the slum clearance that happened, quote-unquote slum clearance, that's what it was called at the time, that
that's
happened
right.
in New York to make way for Lincoln Center, which happened here too in L.A., right, in Bunker Hill.
Well, you know, people say slum clearance as though it has nothing to do with human beings. It's nothing but human beings who are being kicked out of their homes.
Mm-hmm.
It's they really took care of that. It's fantastic.
Speaking of political critique, let's talk about the song America, which you sang, as we just heard a little clip of in the original. That was an interesting critique of America on one level, but also at the time, you had some problems with the lyrics, right?
What happened was that after I struggled and worked like a beast to get this part, I did every test conceivable and audition conceivable for the part of Anita, I decided I was going to start learning the song America, which is Anita's song. And to my astonishment, because I guess I had forgotten, the verse goes like this: Puerto Rico, you ugly island, island of tropic diseases. And I looked at those words and I thought, oh my God, I can't do that. No, I can't do that. I can't do that to my people. It is so detrimental and it's ugly. And I spent a week deliberating whether I was going to turn the part down or try to brave it through. And even the thought of calling my agent, who had worked as hard as I, to help get me this part, the thought of calling him and saying, I can't do this on principle, and I knew what he was going to say. He was going to scream at me, say, are you crazy? Don't give me principle. You are this character. You have to, you know, all that. By just sheer chance, 2 days after I read those lyrics, I got the new script with improvements and all that, which is what you do all the time with script. And by God, the lyric now read, Puerto Rico, my heart's devotion, let it sink back in the ocean. Well, that's different. It's different in the sense that it's Anita who's saying, you know, I don't want to be there. I want to stay where I am here because this is a swell place. But I breathe a huge, huge sigh of relief knowing that I could then not have to call my agent. I could actually do it. And I wonder to this day who might have gotten the part if I had departed.
Right. And what would have happened to your career?
God only knows.
Well, let's talk about that role because there's a really intense scene in the original where your character is almost
raped. By the Jets, the white boys.
The white boys in Doc's store. Doc intervenes. And then in this version, you are the one who intervenes as the shopkeeper, Valentina.
Right.
When the character that you had played so many years ago is now being attacked.
Oh, it's crazy, isn't it?
And so how did that feel for you, being, I guess, in a sense, the savior of your past self from being sexually assaulted?
The savior of my past self. I have to remember that phrase. You're absolutely right. It was eerie. It was surreal. Until that minute, I had always been known as Anita of West Side Story. And I'm suddenly looking into another face. Ariana DeBose, who, by the way, is just marvelous in this. I say that with no caveats whatsoever. It was uncomfortable. It didn't feel real. And I'll tell you, I had a hard time getting myself into that scene. I don't know that I ever succeeded as well as I might have and as I would have wished. I'd been Anita for 61 years, as it were. Mm. And here we were 61 years later, and I'm playing the part of Doc, saying, you know, you boys stop this, you're a disgrace, blah, 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 blah. It was so strange. I don't think it was any more comfortable for Ariana DeBose, who is now Anita. She's the new Anita for the ages. But I think I had a much harder time.
Hmm.
It was difficult. Very.
Yeah. I can imagine. Especially since you, as you recount in the new documentary, were raped in real life by your agent.
I was indeed. Yes, when I was either 16 or 17, I honestly don't remember, but I was very young. And I was also one of those kids who was young for my age anyway.
Did you call on that experience when you were in that scene when you played Anita?
I did not. I did not do that. But what happened to me is that in that scene, for those who haven't seen the movie, the Jets were assaulting me, and they were, you know, it was going to end in a rape, and of course Doc stops it from happening. What happened to me was way more serious, because after rehearsing for several days, we didn't just do, you know, 4-hour rehearsals, we rehearsed that for several days, and I at some point just burst into tears and was sobbing hysterically. I couldn't go on with the scene. And I went to a stool at the candy store counter and put my head on my arms, and I could not stop crying. And, you know, I thought I had been fine before that. But, you know, you forget that sometimes wounds don't heal as well as you think they have.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just one big bleeding wound. And, in fact, they had to stop shooting and call an early lunch because I couldn't stop crying. It was really bizarre. And I remember that the boys knew what was happening to me. They just instinctively knew. And they were surrounding me and hugging me and saying, oh, Rita, please don't cry. Oh, my God, the audience is going to hate us. Please, please, please stop. It's okay. We love you. All of that. And I couldn't stop crying.
Oh, wow.
So there you go. You never know when you're going to be attacked by the past.
Mm. I'm going to have to remember that, too. That's quite a line.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's true. You know, you think you're fine. Or if not fine, you think you're strong. And you're neither as fine or as strong as you may think you are.
So, switching gears just a little bit, I mean, you're talking about being strong and you're talking about fighting and you're talking about trauma and pain. And watching the documentary, I was struck by how much you have had to fight in your life to be taken seriously and to get what you want as an actress and as a human being. In this world, in Hollywood. And, I'm just taken with your tenacity. Although there were very low moments in your life, you did stick through it. And
I have had a lot of low moments in my life, a lot of them, but you go on. I mean, what are you going to do, quit? It's not in my nature. It was not in my mom's nature. My goodness, this is a woman who brought me to America barely knowing a bit of English, working as a seamstress in a sweatshop. And there I was with her. It was astonishing. She was astonishing. I got to tell you, right now, when there's so much beautiful kind of success shining on me, this wonderful light is shining on me, I miss her so much. I want so badly to see my mama again and say, look what we did. I truly miss her terribly.
So when you say we did, that was because the two of you came here from Puerto Rico, leaving the rest of your family behind. And it was just the two of you.
It was just we two.
And she helped you. So she sewed your costumes. She took you to auditions, that kind of thing. And you were partners in your career?
Really were. Yes, we were. It's so amazing. I don't know where she got the strength. She was working as a seamstress in a sweatshop. She would drop me off at school when I was very young, take two buses and a subway to the sweatshop place, and then come back and pick me up after school and on the days when she had a full day of work. She couldn't do that. And I would just stay at school, or she would give me a key and I would open the door of our tenement apartment and look after myself and have some milk and cookies or cake. And that's how it worked. And you know what? It's nothing to feel horrible about because it worked.
So this was in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
You were signed in 1950 by MGM. And,
right.
And then you begin doing contract work for the studio?
Yes, I was under contract to MGM for, well, it was the usual five-year contract, but it didn't last that long. It lasted 3 years. And I think the reason they had to let me go is that they didn't know what to do with me, which is heartbreaking. Why was that so difficult? Well, because I had a Spanish name or a Latina name, and I had dark eyes, and I was always fair-skinned, at least in my family I was. It was a heartbreak. I cannot even describe when I realized that I was definitely not going to be a movie star.
Did you ever consider changing your name? Did you ever think you might have to do that?
No, it never occurred to me. But they changed it for me. Remember that. It was Rosita Dolores Alverio. And then one day the casting director at MGM said to me, got to change your name. And I was kind of thrilled. I thought, how wonderful, because my own name was so always mispronounced. Rosita Dolores Alverio. Alverio turned into some kind of weird mishmash. And I remember he said, what about Orchid Montenegro?
Yeah.
Pretty funny.
That is a little
And
much.
I remember hearing that and saying, and it took guts from me because I couldn't say no to anybody about anything. And I said, well, do you have any other ideas? And then I said, what about my stepfather's last name? He said, what's that? I said, Moreno. And he said, well, that's not bad. And he said, okay, who's your favorite movie star? And I said, Rita Hayworth. He said, Rita Moreno, how's that?
Huh.
And I said, I'm not daring to hear yet another invention of his. I said, yes, that's good.
Well, Rita Hayworth was Latina, right?
Her name was Margarita Cancino.
Huh.
And he was the man who taught me my first Spanish dance class. Her uncle was Paco Cancino, and she was Margarita, which was changed to Rita.
Wow.
Yeah.
You were in a long time, 8-year long relationship with Marlon Brando, which is documented.
I was.
In this documentary.
Yep.
I don't think I knew that. Was it well known that?
You know what? It was known, but not the kind of well-known that well-known is nowadays, because nowadays well-known is major.
Yeah.
It's taken on a new meaning.
That's true.
Because of social media.
Right.
People knew, but it wasn't, he literally kept me hidden. We never went out. And when we did, it would be to an Italian restaurant way downtown L.A. So, you know, a lot of people didn't know.
Why did he keep you hidden?
Because he did not want to have to deal with all that romance crap. in public relations. And he felt that his private life was his business. Mm. Silly boy.
So how did you feel about that, having to sneak around?
You know what? I just took it for granted that that's how it was when you were a king's doxy.
Right. So this was at the when he was a huge star, at the apex of his career.
Oh, he was a huge star. And that was without question. I would never have admitted it then, but it was without question one of his big attractions for me. I had had, at that point, I think 4 or 5 fathers. And at this point, when a man whom I found immensely attractive accepted me, that was a big deal. Mm. So, you know, I was even attached to him for all the wrong reasons. Not all the wrong reasons, because we had a sexually incredible life together. But, you know, that could only work for a while.
Yeah. Well, it seemed to work for a long time, 8 years. Did you want to?
Yep.
Did you want to get married? And
well, it was 8 years on and off.
Mm-hmm.
We would have arguments and disagree, and I would say, I'm done. Knowing that I was hardly done. And then we would separate for a while, and of course, eventually he would call me, and we would get back together, and this went on and on and on for many years. Mm-hmm.
What was he like as a boyfriend? How did he treat you?
He treated me with a surprising amount of respect for someone who's such a womanizer. But he was intrigued with my native intelligence. He couldn't quite get over, for instance, that I knew him inside out. I remember my psychotherapist at the time saying, you have a PhD in Marlinology. Because when you're with someone like that in your life who is tricky and devious and in many respects a liar, you have to be on guard all the time. So I knew everything about him. And it got to the point where when he lied to me, I'd look at him and I'd say, you're not telling the truth, are you? And he would get this funny poop-eating grin on his face. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
But he kind of loved that about me. He loved that I was so clever and as devious as he in some ways, that I knew him inside and out and upside down. It turned him on, in fact.
Wow.
We had a really bizarre relationship.
And then you marry someone who seems to be the exact opposite. A doctor
of
named
course.
Dr. Lenny Gordon, who's not a movie star. He doesn't,
no.
To be honest, have the Marlon Brando looks.
No. But he had a beautiful, beautiful, kind face. Actually, my daughter just reminded me of something that, you know, it's odd. I didn't see it. And the moment she mentioned it, I thought, oh, my God, he resembles Steven Spielberg.
Oh, he does. Yeah.
Yeah, just a skinnier version. And he had a terrific sense of humor. He's probably the funniest man I've ever met in my life. And the second was my husband. Humor is very, very important to me. And I've always thought that humor was sexy.
Mm-hmm.
It's odd. I only just, when my daughter said that the other day, when we were at the premiere and I was hugging Stephen and all that. And I thought, oh my God, he really does resemble Lenny. It's amazing.
And you stayed married till he died, 45 years.
I didn't know how to leave him. It wasn't because I didn't want to. I really didn't know how to leave him. I was scared to death. And he had something to do with this. It was unconscious, I believe, on his part.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, maybe so. That I would be lost without him.
Hmm.
And that I would be helpless without him. And I believed it down to my very bones.
Hmm.
There was that. And then there was Fernanda, our daughter, with whom he had a hugely close relationship. She was definitely a daddy's girl. And she adored him. He adored her. I just didn't think I was fit to handle a separation. in any way, paying the rent, taking care of myself, like I used to before I was married to him. But somehow I got the impression from him, and this was not conscious on both our parts, that if I could not do without him, that he was my savior, that he could take care of me. And let me say something that I also said in the documentary. I do believe that people make contracts with each other about how their relationship is going to be, what, how it's going to take place. And mine was, I'll be your little girl if you'll be my daddy and take care of me. And that's what he agreed to. It was never spoken, but that was so obviously what it was. And then one day when I started to feel that I needed to grow up, that's when the relationship got into trouble.
At what point was that? When was that in your life, in your career?
It started in our seventh year. We were married for 46 years. Mm-hmm. Was it 44 or 46?
It seems like it's 45 years because he died in 2010 and you were married
there you
in
go.
65.
Okay. And I'm 90 now, so I don't remember anything.
You're doing pretty well, let me tell you. I wish I had your memory.
I have a running battle with nouns at this point. Nouns and I have become mortal enemies. So I'm constantly saying to Fernanda, my daughter, you know that thingamajig, or the what do you call it? That's become part of my vocabulary. Thingamajig and what do you call it?
Yeah, that sounds good. Nouns are overrated. There are too many of them.
Then she would say, you know, the thingamajig, or the what do you call it? And she'd say, Mom, no, I do not know. Can you point to it? But I must say, I have a great sense of humor about that.
Well, you have to.
I make myself laugh.
You have to, because there's nothing you can do about it. So,
right.
You pivoted, as I said, into television and found great success there and also on stage. And you won a Tony on Broadway. And you've been in TV recently. And now you're back on the big screen. And it just seems that you have been working since what? Since you were 6 years old?
No, I was five.
Five. Wow.
Yes, 5 years old.
And so maybe that is the secret of your longevity. You just haven't stopped.
You know, very likely. Very likely. And during the pandemic, boy, did I find stuff to do. I am a collector of everything. And I'm a major shopper. And I thought, well, this is a good time to get rid of stuff. I'm still trying. And it's been, what, 2 years now of a pandemic?
Yeah. Almost.
Okay. I haven't succeeded completely because I'll look at something in the closet and I'll say, oh, God, I haven't worn this in 2 years. That tells me I need to get rid of stuff. And then I go to the closet. I say, oh, but this is so cute. No, I'm going to keep this. And before you know it, the closet's still full.
Well, that's a good way to live, with your closets full, so to speak.
Well, it's not bad for a kid who really lived through a lot of poverty. So, yeah. I mean, we were on something called home relief, which at the time was really welfare. Mm-hmm. And I remember very clearly going to this huge warehouse and with my mom and picking clothing for me and for her from different tables. That's how hard it was. That's how tough it was.
Yeah.
But I never perceived it that way. My mom, you know, she always fed me well. She was just a wonderful mom.
Well, it has been wonderful speaking with you. I've had such a great time.
Thank you. Me too. I love your questions.
Thank you.
You do a good interview.
So do you.
Oh, okay. Thanks. Merry Christmas.
Congratulations and happy birthday. That is the one and only Rita Moreno. And you can find out more about her, see her more in a new documentary. It's on Netflix. It's called Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go For It. And of course, she is in the remake of Steven Spielberg's West Side Story, which is in theaters now.
There's a place for us, somewhere a place for us, peace and quiet and open air. Wait for us somewhere.
Coming up, we will remember another Latino legend, Vicente Fernandez, known as Mexico's Elvis. He died yesterday, and appreciation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Yo sé bien que estoy afuera, pero el día que yo me muera, sé que tendrás que llorar.
It's El Rey by Mexican singer Vicente Fernandez, an icon of traditional ranchera music. He died yesterday at the age of 81. Fernandez recorded more than 50 albums during his decades-long career, all of them in Spanish, and he sold more than 50 million copies. Generations of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans grew up listening to him, and today his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame is surrounded by candles and bouquets of roses. Joining us to talk about his life and his legacy is Adrian Felix. He's Associate Professor of Ethnic Studies at UC Riverside. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Vicente Fernandez, he's been compared to Elvis and Frank Sinatra. Tell us why he was so enduring in his popularity for decades and generations.
Vicente Fernandez was part of this generation of iconic ranchera singers to come out of mid-20th century and later 20th century Mexico. And I think what makes Vicente all the more remarkable is, even when compared to some of his peers, is that he crossed all sorts of borders, borders of generations, and his fame, reached well into the U.S. The millions of migrants in the U.S. As migration picked up throughout the course of his career, his following only grew on both sides of the border.
Right, and so he would sell out the Universal Amphitheater. He won a bunch of Grammys here in the United States. And did he have as big a fan base here in the United States as in Mexico?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his music is part of the soundtrack of the Mexican migrant diaspora, I would say. And for those folks who actually got to see him perform live, I mean, it was always a full house, always blew the roof. I saw him even in his later years, and it was remarkable to see just the profound connection that he had with his audience. And audiences across generations, younger folks, older folks, really speaks to just how strong of a connection he had.
Right. Well, talk about that. Was he able to connect with younger audiences? Because he was very adamant in sticking with the traditional sounds of Mexico from decades ago. And so what is it about that is attractive to people such as yourself who are much younger?
Yeah, I think for the children of immigrants in the United States, we grew up hearing Vicente's music, right? His music, Vicente was a household name for migrant families across the United States, because his music spoke about the realities of these communities. He had songs that spoke explicitly about migration and the migrant experience, but it was also music about the homeland and attachments to land and attachments to communities of origin, and the rural landscape that a lot of these migrant families left behind. So I think for those reasons, these recurring threads of nostalgia, of melancholia, which are part and parcel of the immigrant experience, I think that's why it resonated with not only immigrants themselves, but also the children of immigrants who grew up hearing that music in their households via their parents and their elders.
And he grew up poor. His career began on the street corners of Guadalajara. He was a mariachi. And how was he able to become such a big star from his beginnings?
It's part of the remarkable part of his story, right? He, as you mentioned, had very humble beginnings, but eventually began gaining notoriety and fame. He was obviously a very gifted singer, and would eventually start landing bigger shows and bigger gigs, and would launch his very successful singing career in Mexico, which then opened up other avenues. He starred in many movies. You know, he brought a lot of his songs to the screen. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, his fame only grew from there and transcended all kinds of different boundaries and borders.
Right. I read that he was known to perform as long as the audience applauded. And that could mean he would be on stage for like 3 or 4 hours singing. Sometimes he would just drop the microphone and belt it out, dripping in sweat. Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, and to see it live, I mean, he'd share a shot with his audience. You know, he'd take a drink. He'd send shout outs, and even into his later years, I mean, that's the kind of performance that Chente would deliver.
And then personally, he had a crisis in his family when his son was kidnapped. What happened then?
His eldest son, Vicente Jr., was kidnapped. This was early 2000s, so it was kind of before the rash of kidnappings that we see today as part of the ongoing cycle of violence in Mexico. And obviously it was a very high profile kidnapping, this being Vicente Jr. Vicente would later on speak about it very publicly as one of the most difficult and traumatic experiences in his life. He was abducted, he was kidnapped, eventually released for ransom. Was harmed, but was eventually released and was able to return to his normal life. Vicente Jr. also has a singing career, nowhere near as popular as his father or his younger brother, even Alejandro Fernandez. But the family and Vicente Sr. in particular always spoke about this as one of the most difficult and traumatic episodes in their life.
Hmm. But he said that that wouldn't make him turn his back on Mexico, that he would still staunchly proud Mexican, pro-Mexico, even though there was this violence that touched him so intimately, I mean, personally with his son.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Chente really embodied Mexican national identity with all of its contradictions, but was someone who was very much committed to that. Perhaps, you know, more than his son, for example, his youngest son, who's the more successful singer of his children, who was much more kind of transnational, spends part of his time in the United States. Chente was true to his beginnings in many ways. You know, he lived and died in that rancho, that ranch property that he has outside of his Guadalajara, which is, you know, in his home state of Jalisco.
And so what does this mean for ranchera music?
It's definitely, you know, the end of an era. He's the last of the iconic ranchera singers. But, you know, one can hope that legacy lives on and continues. Maybe in his own, we see it in his own children and his grandchildren. One of his grandsons was recently made his debut in ranchera music. We'll see if they actually stick to that or not. But, you know, with the loss of Chente, it definitely is an end of an era for sure.
Well, thank you so much for remembering him with us.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Adrian Felix. He's an associate professor of ethnic studies at UC Riverside. And we've been talking about Vicente Fernandez, the king of ranchera music, who died yesterday at the age of 81. Here is his 1972 hit, Volver, Volver.
Este amor apasionado anda todo alborotado por volver. Voy camino a la locura y aunque todo me tortura, sé querer. Nos dejamos.
And that's it for us here at Press Play. Thank you for beginning your week with us. We love being part of your Monday and part of your life, but we do need your support to keep it that way. And we have a special incentive in place to double your impact. Donate now and help us reach an ambitious one-day goal of $25,000. Friends of KCRW at the Rosemary Kramer Rate Foundation will match that amount, but only if you help us get there by midnight tonight. So we're in this mini fundraiser and we need you to pitch in and donate. And of course, year end, it is tax deductible. So do it now at kcrw.com/give. Thank you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.